for choosing to come to this workshop session and for making it through all of the workshops on this very long Sunday. This workshop is examining civil liberties issues that we've lost and that we're currently working to fight, to defend and bring back.
Following. Could you stand up? Sure.
Sure.
We can see you, we can hear you better.
Sure. So this workshop is about examining the civil rights and liberties that we've lost since 9/11 and the work that activists and attorneys have been doing with the ACLU and with allied organizations over the past 10 years to restore these rights. Our panelists today are Simran Kaur, who is the advocacy manager for the Sikh Coalition. They are a national organization, and right now they're working on a big campaign in California to deal with employment discrimination issues. From ACLU of Southern California, we have Jenny Pascarella, who is a staff attorney who specializes in immigrants' rights issues and national security litigation and advocacy. And our third panelist will be joining us a little bit later, is Zara Bilu, who is the executive director of the Council for American Islamic Relations, the San Francisco Bay Area chapter. So let's give a round of applause and welcome our panelists.
All right, so I'll be going first and talking about some of the general issues that we've seen post 9/11 on a national scale, and doing so through examples that we've been dealing with Southern California in particular. And I've never done this before, but I thought I would start the presentation with a poem to see how you guys like it. This poem is actually in this week's New Yorker, so I thought it was appropriate. It's titled TSA. Off with the wristwatch, the Reeboks, the belt, my laptop's in a bin. I dig out the keys from my jeans and do my best Midwestern grin. At O'Hare, at Atlanta, at Dallas, Fort Worth, it happens every trip. At LaGuardia, Logan, and Washington Dulles, the customary strip. It's never enough for a young brown male whose name comes up at random. Lest the randomness of it be doubted, observe how Myrtle's searched in tandem. How Doris's six-pack of Boost has been seized, and Ethel gets the wand. How polite of the screeners to sham paranoia when what they really want is to pick out the swarthiest, scruffiest of us and pat us top to toe. My fellow Ahmeds and my alien Ali's, Mohammed alias Mo, my buddies from med school, my doubles partners, my dark, unshaven brothers, whose names overlap with the crazies and god fiends. Ourselves, the goateed other.
Who is that by?
I'm sorry, that's by Amit Majumdar. So I wanted to start by talking about one of the biggest changes that we've seen post 9/11 that has led to a lot of different erosions of our civil liberties. And the first one I think is very common for everybody. Obviously, I think you'll resonate with that poem just in the security that we've dealt with post 9/11 at the airports, at the borders. But one thing that may be less apparent is the amount of information sharing that goes on among law enforcement agencies in this post 9/11 security world. And one thing that has been a major shift, that itself has been a major shift in the amount of information sharing that goes on now among agencies, both among federal agencies but also between federal and state and local agencies, is the amount of law enforcement surveillance that we've seen of our communities, and particularly of the Muslim community. So one thing that has become part and parcel of the fight against terrorism is this association by our law enforcement agencies of religious practice as criminal activity. So the mistaking of the practice of Islam in particular as evidence of terrorism. And that may sound like I'm simplifying the matter, but I actually think that when you look at the practices and you look at some of the cases and situations that that I've handled and my colleagues have handled at the ACLU, you'll see how that is apparent. And one story I wanted to talk about, and I think this also goes to the amount in which our own privacy as citizens and civilians is infringed upon by these new practices, is surveillance of both communities and data mining of communities, but also surveillance of our religious institutions. So I wanted to talk about two examples of this. One is, as some of you from the Southern California region might remember in particular, a few years back, I think it was 2007, the Los Angeles Police Department announced a new program called the Muslim Mapping Program. And what this program was an attempt to map out the Muslim community in Los Angeles, because they said that there wasn't any good data about how many Muslims there were, where they lived, where they came from. And so the program was an attempt to map out all the Muslims who lived in Los Angeles. Well, of course, there was a firestorm of criticism, and the program ended up being terminated. They never actually went forward with it. But we now know that across the country, the FBI has essentially engaged in the exact same thing. They just never publicly said they were doing it. And so what we have seen is a massive surveillance apparatus by the FBI, together with other law enforcement agencies, to map out the Muslim population throughout the country, but particularly in places where there's a large population, such as in Southern California. So one example of this, and I think it illustrates the way that these practices are often driven by this improper association of a person's practice of their religion with criminal activity, is a case that we are handling now involving a man named Craig Monte. Craig Monte was a criminal. He spent many years in prison. Through his time in prison, became associated with some white supremacists, and the FBI ultimately went to him and said, you could be a really powerful informant for us. So he spent a number of years working with the FBI as an informant on white supremacist issues. Later they said, you know what, we need you in the national security world, so why don't you come work with us on that? So he agreed, and through a series of trainings and agreements, they gave him the alias Farouk Aziz, I think, and a series of instructions. And those instructions included that he should go to a particular mosque, and this is the Islamic Society of Irvine, in Irvine, California, Orange County, and become close to the imam and tell the imam that he wanted to take shahada, the conversion to Islam, and that he wanted to be a part of their community. He had a long, elaborate story about how his mother was French and his father was Lebanese, and he was coming back to his roots and understanding Islam. So he does this. He goes and he befriends the imam, he takes shahada, the community welcomes him into the mosque, and there began 2 years of infiltrating dozens of mosques throughout Southern California. And his FBI handlers, the people at the FBI who were instructing him, basically instructed him, and he said this now in sworn testimony, that his instructions were to get close to the people who were the most religious. So that is the people who would pray at dawn, because they were the most religious, and because they were so religious, they must be extremists. One of his instructions was to go to the mosque and be there when they open the mosque for early morning prayer, and to take the license plates of all the people who came for early morning prayer. He also was instructed to go to any of the meetings, any of the youth meetings in the mosque, and with recording devices under his shirt to record the conversations, to take video of all the youth that went to those meetings, to collect their names, to collect their cell phone numbers. He collected the names and cell phone numbers of the roster of the people who belonged to the mosque, the membership. So this was a process of both mining information, which goes back to the sort of the mapping of the community, but also very specifically targeting the surveillance, not on evidence of any criminal activity, but simply on evidence of people exercising their constitutional right to practice their religion. So the next sort of, I want to leave you with that, and just I guess want to note that this obviously was a huge scandal when it was revealed publicly, but it wasn't a surprise in the Muslim community. They knew that there were these people that were planted by the FBI in their communities that were there as somewhat as agent provocateurs, as people there to just to incite others, people there to just collect information about them. And the impact that this practice has on the community is obviously fear that if that they are not safe in their own religious institutions, that anything that they say in a mosque could be later somehow used against them. That they shouldn't express their own religiosity, they shouldn't express their own political beliefs because that will be recorded somewhere in the laws of the FBI. So the next piece I think that's important to understand about many of the things that have happened since 9/11, it's not just the sort of overzealous surveillance of our communities and data mining, but some of the specific actions that the government has taken that have really severely restricted people's rights. And one of those is the right to travel. The government has, as you've probably heard and through you know the TSA poem, got a glimpse of, we have extremely overbroad terrorist watch lists. I think the last count I looked at was over 1 million people are on the terrorist watch list. One of the terrorist watch lists, there's various different kinds of watch lists, but over 1 million people are on these watch lists. And there's a number of very significant problems with these watch lists, but essentially what it means in terms of the right to travel is that any person who is on these lists is subject to secondary inspection when they travel. So and usually it's when they're traveling overseas, but oftentimes when they're just traveling domestically. Another big problem with these lists is that there isn't the basic deprivation of due process rights. So people are not told that they're on the list. They only find out when they're subject to, you know, taken into a secondary inspection room, searched and questioned. And they don't provide any real mechanism to get off the list. And the government has now done, you know, countless investigations of the process by which people get nominated to the list and the process by which people get off, and they found that, I think, 35% were nominated by the FBI in error, or there wasn't enough evidence to nominate them to the list, and that tens of thousands of people should have been removed, haven't been removed in a swift way. One very interesting subsect and very problematic subsect of the terrorist watch list is the no-fly list, which many of you, I'm sure, have heard about. And I wanted to show this video because it's more interesting than listening to me talk about it. And then we can talk about some of the other issues.
Yeah.
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 Can I call you?
No, I think it's like right upstairs, but I'll be right back if you want to talk
about
it.
Okay, cool.
Because I think it's worth it.
Well, I'll say what I was going to say about the notify list, and then we can watch the video. So the terrorist watch list, right, is the overarching list that is already, there are far too many people on it. There's over 1 million people on it. The no-fly list is a subset of that, and the no-fly list is essentially what it says, that anybody who's on this list cannot travel, cannot board a plane in the United States, anywhere in the United States, cannot board a plane from anywhere overseas headed to the destination in the United States, or cannot board a plane outside the United States that would traverse U.S. airspace. And I think, let me see, the last numbers I saw, 21,000 people are on this list. And that list was actually doubled in size after the Christmas Day bomb scare, you may recall. So lots of people are on this list, and what it's meant is just the fundamental deprivation of a person's right to travel, whether it's in the United States or outside the United States. And it's particularly, it's significant for anybody who's on the list, but particularly if you're a United States citizen or a lawful permanent resident and you're stuck outside the US because you're essentially being banished from your country of citizenship. And we've been fighting this now for, I guess, almost 2 years. And the main crux of our fight is about the basic deprivation of due process that, like I said, the government is not telling you if you're on this list, and they're not providing any meaningful mechanism to get off the list. There is a redress process, but it's completely, you could call it a sham, because it doesn't actually result in either knowing that you've been removed from the list or knowing what the government did to review whether you should have been on the list in the first place. So again, just to give a concrete example, we had a client. Her name is Halima Satt, and she is a German citizen. She lived in the Los Angeles area, and a few years ago she was flying from Long Beach to San Francisco to attend a conference. She goes through the regular process. She gets her boarding pass, and the flight attendant looks a little confused and starts asking questions of her fellow airline folks at the counter, and ultimately tells her, sorry, you're not going to be able to board this flight. And there ensues a series of things where the FBI comes and questions her, and turns out, ultimately, she's on the no-fly list. Now, the curious thing about her case, when I looked at it, was this is not a person who's had substantial interaction with the FBI in the past, no criminal history, and practically no history in the United States. She was her husband is a U.S. citizen, she had recently moved, I think 2 years prior, as a green card holder to the United States, never been interviewed by the FBI. Her husband is an imam, which was one thing that, to me, stood in my head. but never had any contact with law enforcement. Yet she found herself on this list, and when filed a complaint with the government, with TSA, and we got back a letter saying, we cannot confirm or deny whether or not you're on the list, and we can't confirm or deny whether we did anything to take you off the list. And that is the process that the government is giving to people in all of these terrorist watch lists, which is no process at all, really. So the only way to find out whether or not you've been removed from the list is just to try to fly again. So that's what we're trying to change now through litigation, but maybe now we can watch the video.
Sir, you're not going to be able to board today. And I said, why? you know. She said because we got a message from headquarters in Spain that you can't fly.
When I went to the airport, I went to go get my ticket. I'm at the booth, and it told me to see a ticket agent. Then next thing I know, there's patrol officers walking in. I don't know what was going on. I just know something was wrong. And then I asked the ticket agent, am I on the no-fly list? And she tells me yes.
The federal government's administration of the no-fly list is unconstitutional because they don't even tell people whether they're on or not on the list. The ACLU National Security Project is filing a first-of-its-kind lawsuit challenging the federal government's administration of a part of the watch list called the no-fly list. This lawsuit is being filed on behalf of 10 people, 7 U.S. citizens, 3 of whom are veterans of the United States Armed Forces. All of them have been extremely impacted.
You don't know the value of flying until you're actually put on a blacklist. I cannot go travel for fun. You know, my friends can go, but I can't. I can't go for work.
I'm a disabled veteran, and I have to take evaluations at night. I had an appointment 2 days after I would have been there in Miami, and because I'm on the list, I didn't get a chance to make that. Now, the Veteran Administration is considering cutting my benefits from 50% to 20%.
The federal government offers no process at all for anyone to get their name off of this list with the agency that actually has the power to take you off. And that agency is the Terrorist Screening Center, a subpart of the FBI.
I call my senators, I call congressmen, I call everybody I know trying to figure out why I'm on the list. And it's just no way to get yourself off.
Today it's me, tomorrow maybe you, your daughter, your sister, your mother, anybody.
There's no due process with this. There's nothing that I can do. I just have to sit here and just take it.
The ACLU would like to get our clients off of the no-fly list. And at a minimum, we hope to get them a reason from the government for why they've been put on the list in the first place and to give them an opportunity to stand up for themselves.
I want to go home. You know? I want to go home. I want to see my mom. I want her to see my babies, you know?
So just to finish that off, the story I told you about the woman, Halima Sat, through the litigation that we brought with the national office, although they will never tell us what they're doing and give any real process, they did indicate to us that maybe she should go and try to fly again. And so she went and actually was able to board a plane, and so discovered that she was indeed taken off the list after we filed suit. One final thing I want to mention, and then I'll turn it over, is just one of the additional consequences of this vast information sharing scheme, I guess, that has happened since 9/11, is additional, I would call them collateral consequences for people. And one thing that I'm looking at a lot right now is immigration consequences. So we know now through policies that have just been revealed to us through a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, that the immigration agencies have policies that say that any person, as soon as they apply for a green card or naturalization being the process to become a citizen, if they have what's called, we refer to it as a hit, when their information is run, those of you who sat in on the secure communities, training today, this will sound familiar. Their information is shared with the FBI as soon as they apply for an immigration benefit. If there's a national security hit, which there will be for any person whose name appears in a counterterrorism file with the FBI, that includes any of these people that I mentioned, from the informant that went around and taking the license plates and the cell phone numbers, their names and information are now contained in a file associated with a national security file. They will be deemed national security concerns just because of the existence of their name on a database that is flagged as a counterterrorism database. And because of that national security concern, the government subjects them to a completely different set of processes for processing their green cards and naturalization applications, which means often years and years of investigation about who they are, their lives, their families, their immediate relatives, And the policies essentially say that if the person has one of these national security hits, their applications cannot be approved until they get the sign-off from the FBI or whatever other law enforcement agency contains the record about that person. And so that has meant that essentially many, many Muslim immigrants in the United States have been excluded from very important immigration benefits like green cards and citizenship on account of this massive information sharing and the throwing, really overzealous collection of information about law-abiding citizens. So I'll end there.
So I'm Simran Kaur. I'm the advocacy manager at the Sikh Coalition. We're the largest Sikh civil rights organization in the country. I'm going to be talking about the Amemsa communities, how post-9/11 discrimination has affected Amemsa communities. Amemsa stands for Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, Sikh, and South Asian. But I'll be doing it from a Sikh perspective because that's the organization I represent. But before I start, I just want to get an idea of how many of you have heard of Sikh Americans, or often maybe it's pronounced Sikh. Okay, that's really nice for me to actually see, because oftentimes when I do these presentations, there's a huge lack of awareness. But if there's any questions about the Sikh faith, at the end we can answer those questions. My presentation is going to talk about the sociology of discrimination and how it really impacts an individual's life, public attitudes, political discourse, and how that leads into issues that we see such as bullying and workplace discrimination and hate crimes. 2010 census data shows that Arab, Middle Eastern, and South Asian communities are amongst the fastest growing ethnic groups. And these communities have and continue to face discrimination in post-9/11. Individuals of these communities have been targets of hate crimes and workplace discrimination and school bullying. And so we're going to kind of talk a little bit about what that means for these communities. As we all know, stereotypes are based on fear and perpetuated by the media. So oftentimes we see these images of turban-wearing individuals shown in the media in a very negative way. And you know, the most of the people you'll encounter in the U.S. wearing turbans are actually Sikhs or Sikhs. And so, but you can understand the lack of awareness that when they see these individuals, you know, perpetrated in terrorist attacks, wearing turbans, and then you see me a Sikh in the street, you can understand how people don't understand, the ignorance can perpetuate that. Over time, the popular mind becomes saturated with these negative stereotypes, and ordinary Americans just continue to associate turbans and beards with terrorism. Turbans have been worn by different people around the world for about 3,000 years. For members of the Sikh faith, which is the fifth largest religion in the world, it is religiously mandated, and the turban holds a lot of significance for Sikh Americans. However, turbans and beards continue to be associated with extremism. There's widespread anti-Muslim bias, as you all know, and it's evident by recent polling data. 51% of Americans believe Muslim Americans are disloyal to the U.S. That's a Gallup poll from 2006. Another poll shows us 46% hold negative views of the Muslim religion. 39% believe U.S. Muslims should carry special ID cards. That's another poll. In March 2011, Representative King, chairman of the House Homeland Security, held congressional hearings to investigate the extent of radicalization in the American Muslim community. 52% of Americans surveyed by Gallup supported the hearings, even though this stigmatized an entire religious group.
Can I ask you a quick question? Was that just in New York that they surveyed the people, or was that...
No, it was national. Stereotypes are often used with political stunts. So the first image on the left is a flyer circulated by a lobbying organization in 2005 to oppose regulations on vitamins, if you can imagine.
Vitamins?
Yes. The second image on the right was taken during the 2008 presidential campaign, and as you can see, it plays on people's ignorance and fears. It's becoming more clear that even politicians feel empowered to demean Arabs, Muslims, Sikhs, and South Asians. For decades, African Americans and Latinos had been subjected to racist speech in the political sphere. But most recently, the South Asian Americans Leading Together, SALT, is an organization that published a report in 2010 discussing the rise in racist and xenophobic speech in American political discourse. Remarks included painting these communities as threats to national security and as communities that reject the United States as a religiously pluralistic nation. In addition, South Asian candidates running for public office experienced attacks on actual or perceived religions, foreign-sounding names or accents, and the use of darkened images to show their faces. And so while xenophobia and racism obviously has no place in political and civic discourse, it continues to exist in American society's rhetoric. To talk a little bit about how turbans are perceived, here's an example of a scientific research study that suggests that Muslim appearance facilitates aggressive behavior or aggressive reaction towards a target. So a few years ago, the findings of the turban effect, which is a very interesting scientific research experiment, where volunteers played a computer game that showed apartment balconies on which different figures appeared, some wearing turbans and hijabs and others bareheaded. They were told to shoot at the targets carrying guns and spare those who were unarmed. People were much more likely to shoot Muslim-looking characters, men or women, even if they were carrying an innocent item instead of a weapon. So research suggests that the Muslim appearance facilitates aggressive reactions towards a target, even among relatively tolerant Australian undergraduate students who were the volunteers in this study. Here's another example. This bold billboard, which was purchased by the Sikh community to raise awareness about Sikhism post 9/11, was vandalized with xenophobic speech. Since 9/11, Muslims and people of Arab, Middle Eastern, and South Asian communities have increasingly become the targets of state and federal authorities through policies and practices that result in racial profiling. So government agencies play a huge role in continuing this bias. The TSA policy states that 100% of Sikh turbans will be screened in American airports, and actually most men wear turbans go through secondary screening. Turbans are considered bulky clothing, and the TSA still refuses to audit its screening practices to determine if all bulky clothing is treated in the same way. So there's a lot of inconsistencies occurring. Racial and religious suspicions are reflected in both public policy and practice. The total number of reported hate crime incidents in the U.S. decreased by over 18% between 2000 and 2009. However, during the same period, the percentage of hate crime incidents towards Muslims increased by over 500%. In addition, anti-Sikh hate crimes are not counted by the FBI at this point, and the Sikh coalition is trying to get the FBI to count Sikh hate crimes as well. Recently, we've been hearing more about police departments spying on Muslim groups and on communities in the name of community outreach, which maybe Zahra will talk a little bit more about this. In addition, employers may also not be immune to bias. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits employers from discriminating in employment based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. However, cases of workplace discrimination continue to come up. For example, California Sikhs continue to experience job discrimination because of their Sikh articles of faith, their turban, and their beard. According to a report that we did in 2010, approximately 12% of Sikh Americans living in the San Francisco Bay Area alone believe they've experienced job discrimination. Major law enforcement agencies in California refuse to hire Sikhs. This is even though, you know, Sikhs have a huge reputation of being in the Indian Army, in the UK Army, in Canadian Army, and we've actually been able to grant 3 accommodations for Sikh Americans to serve in the U.S. Army, and they've returned from service with awards. And yet there's still no standard policy allowing Sikhs to be in the Army or law enforcement agencies. There's loopholes in federal law which makes Sikhs and other religious minorities vulnerable in the workplace. So there's 2 types of discrimination here. One is just there's just no religious accommodation, and if an employer at this point can show that the cost of accommodating an individual with religious beliefs is more than minimal, the employer can actually win that case. The second issue is no customer contact. So in the name of corporate image, employers can show that segregated employees suffered no economic harm, and therefore they can win. This past week, Assembly Member Yamada, Mariko Yamada, has introduced legislation, AB 1964, which is the Workplace Religious Freedom Act. And what that's going to do is strengthen, it's going to significantly reduce job discrimination amongst Sikhs and other religious minorities, and also outlaw segregation in California if passed. And I think perhaps maybe worst of all is that children are also not immune to this behavior. School bullying is a huge issue within the Sikh and Amemsa communities. In 2010, a report that we did found that 69% of turban Sikh boys in the Bay Area had been bullied in school. A similar report from New York City found that 60% of turban Sikh children in that area had been bullied. I just wanted to give you an anecdotal example of one of these students that we encountered. He's from Queens in New York, and he wrote to me, and he wrote, "I grew up in Richmond Hills in Queens, and ever since I can remember, I've been treated differently. It wasn't exactly bullying. That started in elementary school. But the other kids just didn't like me very much. I stood out from the rest of them because my turban made me look different. When I got to elementary school, they used to call me Egghead. Loneliness just became a part of my life. After 9/11, things became much worse. Kids called me names and would call me a terrorist. Once on the bus ride home, someone pulled my turban off my hair. I had to walk home without my turban and my hair open, which was very embarrassing. I was crying and wondering what I could do." This student unfortunately went, and he was beaten severely a few days after this incident. Now he's doing a lot better. He's become an activist, and he's trying to share his story so that other individuals can learn about school bullying. So as we've talked about, the media, politicians, and public opinion polls often focus on American public's outcry after 9/11. But less reported and certainly more complex is the fear and dread that post-September 11th has had on the Amemsa communities. Sikh and South Asian, Arab, Middle Eastern, and Muslim individuals find themselves in hostile environments every single day, marked by hate speech and media stereotypes. And hate crimes continue, and so does government stereotyping of these individuals. It's clear that while we've learned a lot over the past 10 years, we have a lot more work to do. And I'm going to end there, but if there's any questions, we can talk about that afterwards.
To stand because I just drove 2 hours from the Bay Area. But my name is Zahra Bidlu. I am the executive director of the Bay Area Office of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. For those of you that aren't familiar with our organization, we're the nation's largest American Muslim civil rights advocacy group. Our office is the oldest, and we like to remind people of that. But I wanted to take a step back and talk about sort of what this looks like for everyday Americans, particularly in a law enforcement context. I was asked to touch on two pieces, which I'll walk through, and hopefully if there's questions afterwards, we can have a discussion about them. The first is the individual client experience, or what this means for everyday American Muslims. And Jenny talked about this with No Fly List, so I'll talk a little bit about the FBI interviews and what they feel like. And then the second piece of it is, what are the local opportunities for advocacy? Because I think that so many times when we have these conversations, it feels like the problem is bigger than all of us, and most of the really bad decisions that are happening in D.C., and we're not there. So what can we do in our own communities? So on the actual individual experience, I share with people that I've been doing FBI representations for a little over 2 years now. And the way, like, this wasn't something that I anticipated doing, but the way I was sort of thrust into it was the fear and the urgency of what it feels like when you open the door and the FBI is right on the other side, and you haven't done anything wrong, you don't know anyone that you think is a criminal, you don't know what to do, and you don't know who to call. And so in January of 2010, I answered some of these calls from community members, and for a long time in our office, we were referring those people out. Like, we didn't have the capacity to do it in-house. And the woman that called me called and said, I opened the door. It wasn't even her, actually. It was her mom that had opened the door. Her mom was an immigrant from Africa. They'd been here for a decade or so, but her mom just had an incredible fear of law enforcement, so much so that the kids weren't even allowed to go to protests, right? So it gives you an idea of how sheltered this family was and sort of how jarring just the experience of opening the door and seeing a couple of agents outside saying, you know, I want to ask your daughter a few questions. So the woman called me and I said, okay, well, here's a couple of private attorneys that can help with this. Give them a call, let me know if you can't get a hold of them. And she couldn't. And within an hour, she was starting to panic, right? And so it wasn't a choice. This was a community member that needed help. And so that was where we made a decision that we were going to start to do these representations. That was over 2 years ago. Since then, our office has received an average of one new complaint each week from someone in the Bay Area who's being visited by the FBI and seeking legal aid. That sounds like a lot, but take that into consideration with the fact that CARE isn't the only one that provides these services. We work in collaboration with the ACLU of Northern California, the Asian Law Caucus, the National Lawyers Guild, and a number of private attorneys, and this is just the Bay Area. So imagine if that's just the number of calls that we're getting, how many visits are actually happening, right? It's one thing to read the investigative pieces by Mother Jones that say thousands of visits are happening, but it's another thing to really think about what this looks like in our communities. In a lot of our cases, we have learned, and we continue to advise clients, that when an individual asserts their rights, it actually very quickly ends the interaction, right? That it sends a signal to the FBI that you cannot go on a fishing expedition in my life, that I know my rights and I'm not willing to talk to you about my community and name my religious leaders and tell you about my political beliefs. That works in the majority of cases. But we hear from people, you know, who didn't know their rights or who didn't think to assert them or who were too afraid to assert them. The best one for me really is people who believe that if I just cooperate, it will get better or it will get easier. We've represented people who have accidentally taken lie detector tests, thinking there is, you know, no harm in taking a lie detector test. Clearly they didn't grow up watching Law and Order and Cops the way I did. But you know, they sit down, they talk to the FBI, they think I'm just doing my civic duty by talking about everything I know and answering all of their questions. And at the end of the conversation, the agent will sometimes say, you know, I believe everything you say, but will you take this lie detector test to prove it? Right? And sure enough, in cases that we've worked on, the people have failed the lie detector test, right? And that's why they're not admissible in court, because generally people will fail them if they're nervous, if they haven't prepared, if they haven't done so in consultation with an attorney. But by the time a person has failed a lie detector test in an FBI office without representation, quite often they're in a lot more trouble than they're going to be able to get themselves out of easily. We've had clients who've been asked about who their religious leaders are, so they open their doors, they say, you know, the FBI says we just want to do some outreach, and it's, you know, who's the imam at your mosque, who's the religious leader at your mosque, who teaches the Arabic classes you go to. I had a client who was asked, you know, how well do you speak Arabic? And he said, oh, like, you know, I'm conversational. And they said, on a scale of 1 to 5, what do you think? And he said, I don't know, a 3. And to his surprise and his fear, the FBI agent then started to converse with him in Arabic to test his skills. These are things that I think I wouldn't believe had I not been representing clients who, you know, who'd actually had these experiences. And that's why I share them, because I think it's so important to really understand the level of fear that exists, whether it's for young people quite often, for college students quite often, the FBI shows up before they're even awake for school. Yes.
I was going to ask about that, because I live in a climate of feeling like my academic institution is infiltrated by the FBI very regularly, particularly in my department, and there are students that I know work for them.
And I'll talk about that towards the end, because there's like this really fine line on balancing fear and empowerment, right? And so I think as advocates, and I think all of you have this experience, is when we have these conversations, we're not trying to make people afraid.
Right.
But I say that to say that it's important to know what to do and what your rights are in that situation, or if you think that there are people in your department that are agents or that are, you know, regularly conversing with the FBI, and at the same time, how do we go there from a place of indignation and sort of empowerment rather than fear? But definitely, like, we know...
I'm more like animosity than fear myself,
right.
But I thought that was...
Yeah, no.
...thing, you know?
And that's true, right? So we've definitely heard from students on campus who are advised by their administrators, sure, just go ahead and sit down with the FBI agents, right? Or, you know, the funny thing about
working with the FBI is that when we say informant, I think that what comes to mind is a guy in Irvine who made lots of money, more than $100,000, continuously referring information over. But the way I explain it to the community is that when people don't assert their rights, they put not only themselves in danger, but their communities in danger, because talking to the FBI and collaborating and conversing with the FBI doesn't always look like the guy that gets the big check. Sometimes it's just the guy that answers his phone regularly, and does put everyone in danger. We've had clients who, and this is the last piece I'll share on client interaction, is the Arab Spring, right? Because we all celebrated the Arab Spring, the Obama administration celebrated the Arab Spring, we thought it was a good thing. But what we didn't talk about was that there were people across the country who were then, last year, and continue to be visited by the FBI and questioned about the Arab Spring. So we saw Egyptians being visited, Libyans being visited, Tunisians being visited, and this year we're seeing Syrians being visited. And they're all being asked things like, well, what do you think about the Arab Spring? And, we want to arm the insurgents in the Arab Spring. How do we do that? And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, who's sitting there having this conversation with law enforcement about arming insurgents in another country? But this is a very real experience. We just heard from people last week who were visited and who sat down and had coffee with the agents and had these conversations. And I'm thinking, this is the last thing that you want to do. But this is a very sort of, this is reality for the MMSA community these days. And the overlap with ESCOM, really quickly, just to point it out, is a community trust factor, right? There's, of course, the technical factor about the FBI's role in ESCOM versus the FBI's direct role here, but also the community trust factor. And this takes us to the local advocacy. Is when local law enforcement is cooperating with the FBI in this way, it undermines the credibility of all law enforcement, right? So similar, the model example within ESCOM is a woman is not going to call, or the victim of domestic violence, male or female, is not going to call local law enforcement where ESCOM is in place because they're going to be afraid about having their spouse deported, right? They just want the beating to stop. They don't want the parent of their children to be deported. So we face a similar situation with the FBI. Following 9/11, the Joint Terrorism Task Force has been created across the country, and so dozens or hundreds of local law enforcement agencies signed contracts with the FBI, essentially saying we will cooperate with you to fight terrorism in our community. In San Francisco, it's three officers that are assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. In Oakland, it's one. In Berkeley, it's one. But it varies from community to community. And earlier on in this process, as these contracts were being rolled out, local agencies were saying, we really want to protect national security. We want to work towards national security together with you, but we also want to protect local values. And so you saw cities carving out local values and saying, we're not just going to accept a contract that the FBI writes because it's problematic. San Francisco was one of those cities where they said, yes, we're going to join the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but we're going to carve out protections, right? So we're going to ensure that the officers that are SFPD officers are going to be held accountable to San Francisco values, because we're not going to pay for civil rights violations within our own communities, because we understand how important it is that the MMSA community and all communities trust the SFPD to the extent possible without having it be tarred by a relationship with the FBI. So there was one contract that was signed. The contract was amended and signed again, and then amended and signed again. I think we're in our third iteration, right? Okay, so we're in our second iteration in San Francisco. The first one left in the civil rights protections. The second one, the first one left in the civil rights protections and also had a very public process in terms of collecting community input and making sure it wasn't just one person secretly signing it. In 2010 in San Francisco, the police chief made some incredibly racist remarks where it's interesting that a few words were indicative of sort of a larger systemic problem and really helped move the community. I mean, yeah, it's funny what wakes the community up and what moves us to action, but I think those words about, we're really concerned about people from the Middle Eastern community parking a van in the Hall of Justice and blowing it up, could really move the community to action and help form a coalition that has now been working on this issue for over 2 years. And so following those statements and a number of other concerns that were raised in San Francisco about intelligence gathering by the SFPD, the ACLU and the Asian Law Caucus submitted a Public Records Act request to the SFPD and said, we want to see a copy of your contract with the FBI. We have your old contract, we want to see what the new contract looks like. And it took months to get a copy of this contract.
the runaround was almost hilarious. It was, you know, we don't have copies of it locally. It's owned by the FBI. It's secret. We can't share it with you. And so when we finally got it, we understood why they'd been hiding it. They'd been hiding it because all of the protections that had been carved out in the first contract had disappeared. Not only that, there had been no open process in terms of signing the contract, right? So since 2007, the SFPD had been participating with the FBI in the Joint Terrorism Task Force and had discarded San Francisco values and any concern about the California Constitution. So what are the local opportunities here? This goes back to my earlier point about, you know, a lot of times when we talk about the FBI or we talk about national security or immigration policies, it feels like these decisions are made so far away. And San Francisco has been, I think, a real great model of it follows in the footsteps of Portland. Portland was one of the few cities that had said, we're not going to participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force at all. Following the Portland Christmas tree bombing incident, or alleged tree bombing incident, we saw sort of the backlash for that, right? We still don't know whether or not he was entrapped, as we call it, we don't call it. But the backlash to that was that Portland said, okay, we're going to participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but we're going to set our own rules. We're going to write our own contract, and we're going to have a very public process by which we make this decision. And you saw the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office coming out and participating in public dialogues with members of the community addressing civil rights concerns. The contract that they put into place in Portland keeps in place three main things, which we focused on in San Francisco as well. The first is ensuring that Portland police officers that are paid for by Portland taxpayers are accountable to local laws and values, right? So that we know that the FBI's civil rights guidelines are a floor, and a very low floor at that, right? But that local communities have placed higher protections on civil liberties than the FBI in Portland, and we're going to respect those. On top of that, we're going to create reporting guidelines, right? So annually, the Portland police chief is required to report to the city council in a very public fashion what activities the Portland officers assigned to the JTTF have been engaged in, right? And so this is a huge victory, because you go from a place of where the contract is private and we can't even tell you what it says to we're going to tell you what we're doing. And so in San Francisco, first we went to the Human Rights Commission, and we said, look, we've got these major civil rights violations, and we continue to hear from people who are afraid to even come forward and report their complaints to the various oversight bodies within the police department to make a difference, because they don't want to be targeted by law enforcement. There's something really difficult to understand about reporting police complaints to the police, particularly if you're afraid of the police. The Human Rights Commission said, we agree with you, and moved it forward to the police commission. And this is where it got stuck, and we were sort of stuck for several months here, because the police commission continued to meet secretly. Members of the police commission continued to meet secretly with the FBI, who would tell them that, you know, they're lying about what's happening in Portland, which is contrary to everything the leaders in Portland were saying. You know, if you don't participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force in San Francisco, won't be safe from terrorist attacks, right? So it's not necessary. Right, exactly. It's pushing legislators and appointed officials based on fear. Right, so this idea of
coercion.
Yes, exactly. And so the police commission didn't move. And so we went to the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. And Supervisor Jane Kim introduced legislation there late January of this year. And it was really powerful to see that more than half of the Board of Supervisors had co-sponsored the legislation, right, to say that, you know, we care about this issue, it's really important. And it's not just an MMSA issue. It affects the Chinese community, the Russian community, the LGBT community. Today it's Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians. Tomorrow it's someone else's.
I wanted to mention that it also affects the activists. I have a friend who was flying yesterday from the Bay Area, I don't know if it was San Francisco to Portland, and he was detained by Homeland Security because he was placed on the terrorist watch list, because he's federally indicted pursuant to the Patriot Act, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism thing, for passing out flyers. It threw out the case, but they harassed the hell out of him yesterday. And I'm going to ask you what he can do. He left me a message yesterday and asked me, what can he do to get back at that? So in Portland, are they required to make a report on the fact that they, well, I don't know if he got harassed in the Bay Area or in Portland, but you're saying if it happened in Portland, they have to report on that or something?
So I want to say he should probably talk to Jenny afterwards about the specifics of the case, but in what I'm specifically referring to is Portland officers that are participating in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, right? So if it were
Portland officers at the Portland airport that had participated in this process, then depending on sort of what they engaged in, there's a possibility it would show up in the report. In most cases, and the problem that we see with this is that there are so many agencies doing so much work in this sector that it's not that clean cut. And this is a problem that we were running into in San Francisco as people were being visited by law enforcement. They were stopped at the airport, they were being questioned about First Amendment protected activity, and half the time they didn't even know who the officers were.
With the questioning that occurs, it's all like in private spheres, right? They're not being taken to a FBI headquarter office.
They are at times.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Right. And so people are oftentimes taken to FBI headquarter offices. And I mean, they're not forced to go. They're just gently asked if you will come. But, you know, when someone with a gun and a badge asks me to go somewhere, I'm probably going to comply. And that's the case for most ordinary Americans, so I would advise not to ask if you're free to leave.
So should you say I request not to go altogether?
So if you are asked to go somewhere by law enforcement, whoever the agency is.
Or if they're at your door and they ask to come in and talk.
So if they ask, do you want me to do So if you're ever approached at home by law enforcement, I'm sorry, I just wanted to check quickly to make sure I could divert in this way, but if you're ever approached by law enforcement at your home and they ask to enter your home, it's important to keep in mind there are three ways that law enforcement gets into your home. First is an emergency, right? So if they're in pursuit, if there's a domestic complaint. The second is with a search warrant. So you should ask if they have a search warrant, right? You should review the search warrant before you let them in. And even if there is a valid search warrant and you let them in, you have the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. So that doesn't go away even if there's a valid search warrant. The third way is consent. And that's how we find most people will let law enforcement into their home. So in most cases, there isn't an emergency, and in most cases, there isn't a search warrant. They say, can we come in? And most folks will say, sure, why not? Because, you know, they don't want to be rude. They're afraid of law enforcement. They don't know what's wrong. And they think that if they cooperate, that it will just go a lot easier. So I always advise people to step outside, close the front door behind you. And then if they ask, you know, can we come in, ask them for a search warrant. So that's how that interaction should go. Does that answer the question?
It's also about going to their office.
So, and if they say, will you come with us, I would always urge you to say, you know, am I free to leave? If you are free to leave, then you should not go with them. If you are not free to leave, then you're probably under arrest, and they should be reading Miranda rights to you, and then you should assert your right to counsel. So even if you get to FBI headquarters, you're not obligated to talk to them. No matter what you do in this process, you always have the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. So even if you waive it at the beginning of a conversation, you can assert it in the middle of a conversation.
Thanks for that. Yeah. Just so long as it's a voluntary interview, the person always has the right either to refuse the interview or to set the terms of the interview. So they can say, I'm not going to meet you at, they don't have to say it like this, but not meet them at the FBI headquarters or whatever, but set a neutral place where they can meet on neutral ground. And that helps the person kind of have the confidence that they're not going to be tricked into something that they didn't sign up for, that they can take back some of the power in the situation. When we do it in Southern California, we always have them come to our office. So we're setting the terms of the interview and deciding the parameters of it.
Why would you have them interview at all?
Well, yeah. Brilliant question.
Oh, and one that we struggle with.
I personally, it really depends on the circumstances of the person's case. If the person is not a citizen, I will, because of some of the reasons I talked about, I will often advise not to speak with them. But we know that there are often complications of that, and there are ways in which the FBI has been retaliating against people. One way is by putting them on a terrorist watch list. And so it really it depends on sort of a careful evaluation of the circumstances of the person's case.
And then I just had a follow-up of your talk, and I was wondering, you know, there was a lot of litigation on the Japanese internment camps. Doesn't it seem like the no-fly list and these people that are stuck who are U.S. citizens is very similar to that, where they're taking their property or their lives and they're locking them up, but in a different way?
Exile.
Yeah, it's conceptually very similar. It is a form of exile.
I don't know, it just seems like we've been through this before.
Yeah.
And if we consider, you know, where we're now paying people because of because of, you know, the egregious nature of the civil rights violence and so on.
It's in constitutional law, it's called banishment, when you banish a citizen without providing them the process. And for a citizen, there's only very narrow circumstances in which a person could be stripped of their citizenship. And usually it has to do with being a traitor and things like that. And so by basically banishing people when they're outside the country, it creates enormous constitutional problems. And also for lawful permanent residents who are effectively stripped of their own entitlement to the residence in the United States because there are time limitations associated with their residency, and if they're outside the United States longer than 6 months, it can complicate their residency and eligibility for naturalization. And so, and their immigration law is very clear that they can't be stripped of their permanent residency without due process. And so, yeah, it's definitely, there's many parallels.
Well, so, sorry, I lost track on the KYR piece, because, no, it's okay, the favorite part of my conversation is when we talk about, you know, what are your rights when this happens, and how that knowledge is so important, because whether or not it happens to you, it may happen to someone you know, and the peer-to-peer conveyance of this information is critical to the protection of our communities. On the local legislation piece, really, really quickly, so Jane Kim introduced legislation in January. It was co-sponsored by more than half of the Board of Supervisors. However, we didn't have a veto-proof majority. And it was interesting to see the leadership in the police department, but also the mayor's office, threaten publicly to veto the legislation, saying, you know, we don't want to divest authority from the police department to participate in counterterrorism work, because counterterrorism work is so critical in San Francisco, and we've got such high terrorism risk, but really we don't want to take away authority from the police department. It's not the job of the legislators to put into check the power of the police department, which is sort of laughable from a civil rights perspective. We did a lot of community organizing. Hundreds of people came out to rallies, wrote to the mayor, visited their supervisors. And what happened, finally, actually just a couple of weeks ago, as the Board of Supervisors passed the legislation on a second vote, in San Francisco, the supervisors have to vote on it twice before it goes to the mayor's office. So they passed it a second time and headed to the mayor's office, and the mayor finally said, okay, let's look at compromise, right? Forced us to remove, not forced us, but moved us to remove a lot of the various community-based civil rights findings that would have gone into legislative history but not the administrative code. Forced us to remove a number of sort of minor pieces, but actually was pushed by the community towards compromise legislation. The compromise legislation covers three key points that the coalition identified as important. The first is bringing San Francisco police officers under local control, right? Specifically, one of the concerns that we had that sort of fueled all of this was that the FBI was saying that under this MOU, we are in charge of your officers, right? The three officers that you assign to us, report to us, are accountable to us, and are held only to our standards. So the compromise legislation says, no, that's not the case, that they will be held to San Francisco values and standards as well as the California Constitution. The second one is it forces that any new agreement or amendments to the agreement go through a public input process. So the last time, in 2007, one of our concerns was the police chief signed it, didn't check with anyone, not even the city attorney's office, before signing a contract that bound the city's police officers. So any new contracts or amendments to the current contract would require public input. And then the last one is this annual reporting requirement, right? That really forces the police department to come forward and say, okay, this is what we are doing with tax dollars. This is where we feel that law enforcement activity based on First Amendment activity of individuals and citizens is key, and here are the reasons, right? And so an annual reporting requirement is being put into place. It was introduced last week, and we're moving forward with it in the next couple of weeks, and so we anticipate that it will be signed into law by mid-May. And the reason we share this story is because I think it's really important that people not leave these conversations thinking, gosh, I can't fly to D.C. tomorrow to do anything, right? The question really is, why is happening in your local cities? Are your local police officers participating in this erosion of our civil liberties? And the first step really is finding that contract between your police department and the FBI. So with that, I think we'll move to questions.
I was going to ask, is it just a matter of going to a local PD and saying, like, I, as a citizen and taxpayer, want to know which of the PD specifically are part of this?
So they won't tell you the names? Oh, they won't do that. They won't. The way you'll find that out is by figuring out who's complaining about which officers in the community. That's how we did it in Oakland. and we stopped short of printing his face and name on flyers and then putting it up over the community. We thought that might not be good. But in general, each city has various sunshine ordinances in place. And so you can use the local sunshine ordinances to request copies of various government documents, including the MOU.
Define what a sunshine ordinance.
Sorry, so a sunshine ordinance is a local version of the Freedom of Information Act. And so it's, you know, a really good way to get copies of local documents the same way you would use the Freedom of Information Act to get federal documents.
All right, I just wanted to make a further comment about open records. Unfortunately, California's Open Records Act is actually more generous towards law enforcement than the Federal Freedom of Information Act is when it comes to getting information about actual investigations.
Oh, I think we saw that with the report that was released about the 911. They refused to talk about
actual incident reports and that kind of thing. Yeah, so California has made it really hard for civil rights advocates to be able to sort of reconstruct you know, what actually goes into these types of investigations. So it's all the more important to, you know, for people to talk to fellow community members about what's happening.
I was wondering if any of you could speak to the gag orders that are that the law enforcement community uses against businesses that they try and compel to give information on terror suspects for that practice.
The libraries, you know, they had to turn over books, people got out of the library and that kind of thing.
But then they're not, I guess you guys don't have much information on that, but yeah. I mean, there was practices where they don't allow the businesses to talk about being investigated or doing a lot of them to challenge it before through the gag order.
I'll tell you, I'm not familiar with the policies. I can tell you a couple of experiences that clients and community members have had. This isn't related to the gag orders, but there's also the Bank Secrecy Act, right, which requires, there's various bank regulations in place that require that banks turn over information about transactions that make certain hits in terms of terrorist activity or suspicious activity. And so we've definitely seen in the Bay Area, just like in the last year, we've seen, I think, over a dozen people who've had their bank accounts closed with no explanation whatsoever, right? So that's one where we see law enforcement secrecy and bank secrecy having an impact on individual citizens. We had a client last year, and we were not able to resolve this case, but this has happened a couple of times now with different people who have lost their jobs because law enforcement has visited their employers and then instructed the employer, you know, we're inquiring about this individual or that individual, but, you know, you can't tell him. And so the employer freaks out and fires the person because they don't want to be employing someone who's being investigated by the FBI. And sometimes we'll casually tell the person, it's because law enforcement is interested in you, but I can't tell you anything else. And so there isn't an actual gag order in place, but there is there's the use of fear as a method of coercion.
Those things go back to the Patriot Act, including the kinds of things you're talking about in.
I think the ACLU actually won the gag order issue before the Second Circuit, if I'm not mistaken, in a case a few years ago. And then there was subsequent compromise legislation. But I think it's considerably better than it was in 2001 when the Patriot Act passed.
Other questions?
I guess I'm curious about the legality of the no-fly list, because if I understand it, you can still cross the borders, right? But you can board a plane in Canada or Mexico. So what is the no-fly list doing?
You can't come back.
But you can cross like by car.
Yeah,
or
but
what?
If you're stuck on the other side of an ocean, then you are stuck on the other side of an ocean. And if you try to come like on a boat or something, like you still have to go through customs.
Well, is it a customs thing or just
it's a flying thing, right? So it's specifically about the dangers of air travel.
So you could fly to Mexico.
So you could, you're right. You could fly to Mexico and theoretically cross the border by foot. We have some of the clients, I'm not forgetting the story, but one of the clients in the case that the video was about, had this insane story. He was one of the vets who was living in England, and his wife was back in the U.S., and he discovered he's on the no-fly list when he was in England, and but he only found out that he was on the list when his plane, which was en route to the U.S., decided in the middle of the Atlantic that he was on the list, and they needed to divert the plane and went all the way back. He deboarded the plane, and there began this odyssey to get back to the U.S. where he had to fly to Peru and then to Panama. I don't know. It became this like whole odyssey to get back by land. In effect, it is a banishment, and that's the point that we make in the law. So even though you could potentially cross by land, the difficulties of actually doing that are so enormous in many cases that.
I understand still the banishment. I was just pointing out that it was more like, I mean, if they were, you're going to like compromise the plane, you're still in neighboring airspace, so what are you doing here?
That's right, yeah. That's a great point. Other questions?
Do you have a suggestion? We have a gentleman on our board in Chico who goes to a mosque and is saying that he feels like that same feeling, you know, that they feel they're being infiltrated and they, you know, pick out somebody who's new and never seen before and, you know, and everybody has that sense that, you know, in this small, kind of small town, whatever, 120,000 people. And is there any sort of process to go through with that to bring back? I mean, what are people doing when they're feeling this sense that they've got eyes watching over them and they're in their own church or their own mosque or whatever?
My response would be that we need to get to that community and give them Know Your Rights presentations and help them understand what their rights are if they're actually confronted by the FBI.
Not so much how do you get rid of the anonymous eyes. In other words, you don't want to turn out to be just like the FBI people and go, you're not allowed in my mosque because you're an infiltrator, because then you're doing the same thing they're doing to you. But is there any creative way for these peace groups, anybody, where you feel that sense, your intuition is telling you, you're being watched, taped, you know, your license plates are being copied up. Any affirmative kind of thing that you can do before things get on some mystery no-fly list or security, you know, tab.
So the Minnesota 23 is, I think, what they're called, the 23 folks that were served with grand jury subpoenas, like, in 2010 after anti-war organizing in the DNC. And they had a really interesting reaction to this question, so I'll share it. They had an infiltrator in their midst during the DNC protest organizing, and when they were, you know, when it came out that this person was an infiltrator, they were asked, well, sort of, what'd you feel about it? And they said, well, she lifted a lot of chairs and tables, right? So they decided to get the most work out of this member of their community as possible while she was there. And that's a really optimistic approach to it. A really sort of frightening reality is that we've heard stories from mosques in Northern California who have done just that, where they've alienated the stranger, whether it's someone who's new or someone who is a convert. And the personal story that I share with people is that my husband is a convert. And when I first got married, I had someone in the community approach me and say, you know, they're like, those white men, they're pretending to be Muslim, but they're really FBI agents. And I was like, what? Right? And so that gives you sort of an understanding of the level of fear. And yes, we need to do Know Your Rights presentations there. I mean, that's really all that we can do. And what I urge people at the baseline is that you should never, unfortunately, this is frightening, but we live in the era of Big Brother, you should never say or do anything you wouldn't want to see in an FBI file or on the front page of the New York Times. Now, if that means that you are going to engage in civil disobedience, be proud of what you're going to do, but realize there's always a risk that it'll end up, you know, an FBI file. But that's it. That's all we can do. We can urge people to not be afraid, because that's the most destructive thing for these communities. Sorry, one afterthought. It's also interesting because in communities of color, law enforcement is doing heavy outreach because they want to diversify their staff. So sometimes we do have FBI agents who are legitimate participants of mosques, and I think that just confuses me a lot.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Yeah, I think
that
the panelists.
all three of you kind of spoke. Simran first spoke to how media portrayals and politicians' fear-mongering and political theater have kind of served to isolate the MMSA community in many ways and otherwise the kind of discrimination that MMSA community members face. But each of you also spoke to the intersectionalities between the issues that MMSA community members face and also the connections to the Latino community and immigrants' rights struggles, African-American communities and issues that they face with police and law enforcement, racial profiling. So I'm wondering, from an activist perspective, how can we more effectively utilize those intersections to build our power across what are really very similar struggles and campaigns, but are framed by the media and politicians in ways that pit us almost against each other?
I think that's a really important question. It's probably the crux of the solution because, as you had mentioned earlier, you know, the Japanese have gone through this, Latinos have gone through this, African Americans have gone through this. The brown is just the new black right now. So basically, you know, one of the main things that we can do is work in coalitions and not work in silos. A lot of the work that we've been successful at has been in coalition building with other organizations that have gone through these similar things and also other organizations that go through the same thing. So instead of working in silos, my advice would be to work in coalitions as much as possible.
I agree with that completely. I think one thing that I think, just to add to that, that I think is interesting within the ACLU is the way that we structure the issues sometimes leads to more siloing than the kind of understanding the intersections. And at the ACLU, we, for the past number of years, we've had an immigrant rights project and we've had a national security project, but the two don't ever work on the issues that intersect. And so what I see, my job and the work of the ACLU of California is really trying to work at the intersection of those two issues because they're very much the same in a lot of ways. And the more we can understand those intersections, the better we can fight it.
Be intentional about coalition building. I think that what we've seen with the Coalition for a Safe San Francisco, which is the coalition leading the JTTF work in San Francisco, is that there are so few of us doing so much work, and that's the reality in each of these silos. And so we don't often stop to look for unexpected partners, right? Like we partner with, in the Muslim community, for example, the natural partners are the mosques and the other Muslim organizations, right? But then stepping outside of that and saying, okay, well, what about the Sikh organizations? What about the Asian American organizations, the civil rights organizations? An interesting case study, I think, is, and hopefully someone will slow down enough to actually look at this, is the NYPD and how that organizing has been happening, right? When you look at sort of all of the complaints about the stop and frisk practices against African American men, the question that arises for me as an American Muslim woman is, where is the MMSA community on that organizing? Like, why aren't we there participating in challenging the NYPD's targeting of black men? Now flip that and say, well, what about the NYPD's mapping of the Muslim community? Well, where is the African American community on that struggle? Where is the Latino community on that struggle? I suck at statistics, like I'm just terrible at them, but the second one that I've memorized this year is, seriously, like it's so bad. It was like 3 out of 4 New Yorkers were okay with the mapping plan.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Like 3 out of 4 New Yorkers are okay with the mapping plan. What does the statistic look like for the stop and frisk issues, and why aren't we building power there? A colleague of mine at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Sharon Pitard, like frequently says that filling a room isn't enough these days, right? Like you've got to be able to fill a room and make change. And I think that if we're filling a room with people that look like ourselves all the time, we're not going to be able to push change. Yeah.
First, sorry for the question. Are Persians part of your organization?
Sorry?
Persians part of your organization?
So, do you want to talk a little bit about
MMSA? So MMSA is... It's an interesting definition, right? And I think what we've been finding over the past few years is that it doesn't encompass all the groups that should probably be encompassed in this definition. So I don't know where the definition actually arose, but...
Arab, Middle East, so Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, South Asian. I think we just needed a short way to say all of those things. And so in the MMSA organizing that happens in the Bay Area, you'll see that Persian Americans will be included in that organizing, and they find intersections between, I think, Middle Eastern and Muslim.
Yeah. My real question was kind of related to that.
whole other concept.
Yeah.
You know, I think the one thing that comes to mind for me is that a lot of times, well, actually quite often, law enforcement harassment in this country is tied to foreign policy and activities that happen in other countries, right? So when we're looking for UNRWA, all looking in Yemen, all of the Yemenis are being visited. When there's a revolution happening in Egypt, many Egyptians are being visited. So to the extent that war in Iran, or war with Iran, or an invasion, or basically murder of innocent Iranians would mean Iranian Americans would be visited by law enforcement, I think that we could expect that. And I mean, and they're already,
yeah, they are already
visited by law enforcement as a result of the military.
Mike?
I guess this goes back to what you're talking about, the silos. But a couple of communities that, let's say, in the last 15 or 20 years have had a lot of success with coalitions and openness would be disability and LGBT, particularly regarding gay marriage, where at least on a long-term trajectory, you're going to get a lot more productive results. More people are aware of how everybody behaves in a given community in the general public. This would have nothing to do with the FBI, of course, but when you're in coalitions, when you're in one-on-one situations, I just think the more openness, the better, in terms of starting conversations, not just being willing to participate in a conversation. And that just creates more acceptance over the long term. That's not going to be a short-term solution.
Any question? Head on to the NYPD. I'm trying to find out what gave the NYPD legal authority to spy on the mosque in New Jersey.
So we would argue that they didn't have authority to do that, but that's probably going to take at least a couple of years to resolve.
Final questions? Okay, well, let's hear a round of applause.
Thank you.
So workshops are done for the day, and dinner tonight is on your own. So feel free to explore downtown Sacramento.